The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 14th of January, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals, HZM. And Jeremy discusses the company's general progress, including the award of their construction license for the Araguaia project in Brazil. Also on the podcast, David Ciclatira, Executive Chairman of Live Company Group, LVCG. And David discusses what's been achieved for the company in 2018 and what's to come in 2019. Also on the podcast, I have Miles Pelham, Chairman of Obtala, that's OBT. And Miles provides highlights from their quarterly update. Plus, I have Malky, Oil and Gas Sector Specialist, talking about the following companies: Faro Petroleum, Ofire Energy, SDX Energy, President Energy, Amerisa Resources, and Premier Oil. Plus, as always, I have two lists, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see top 10s versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals. That's HZM ticker. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, good morning. Good to speak to you, and belated Happy New Year.
Yes, you too. You've had some decent news out here to give the share price a lift, and we'll go into that in a bit. Before we do, as always, I hate to assume, so if someone's listening to this for the first time or not quite familiar with Horizonte, can you explain what you're all about, please, Jeremy?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a London and Canadian-listed development company. We have two main assets that we own 100% of. The Araguaia ferronickel asset in northern Brazil, which we completed a feasibility study on in Q4 last year. And that is the focus of today's press release, being awarded its construction license. Mm-hmm. And also we have a second asset within trucking distance of Araguaia, the Vermelho Nickel Cobalt project that we acquired from Vale early last year. So there are two assets, 100% owned, strong shareholder base, and we're aiming to build out a 40 to 60,000 ton a year nickel business.
Yeah, well, you've got this construction license awarded, and this is a major sort of hurdle or sort of, you know, major sort of step towards progressing the mine. So give us, you know, the significance of this, and what's left really before you actually start sort of building here.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously Araguaia is a discovery that the company actually made. So it was a grassroots discovery, and we've taken it all the way through acquiring adjacent discoveries from both Glencore and Teck, two of the largest mining companies in the world. We released obviously a feasibility study in Q4 last year, and this construction permit is a key milestone and a major de-risking step. We were awarded the preliminary license 2 years ago, which is approval of the SEIA, etc. And for the last 18 months, in parallel with the feasibility, we've been working very hard to deliver all the documents and comply with the conditions to get this construction license. And what it means is today we can go into the project and we can actually start building the process plant. We have the relevant permits to do that. So from a financing point of view and project financing, this is a major de-risking step.
Yeah, and just take us through some of the figures from that feasibility, if people are not aware, if you could, Jeremy.
Yeah, so the feasibility shows a sort of a stage one base case scenario where we're producing around 14,500 tons of nickel a year, and that generates over $1.6 billion of free cash flow over the 28-year mine life. And if you bring the second process line into double production up to around 30,000 tons of nickel, and we've modeled that coming in year three, so no extra capex, that takes that free cash flow from 1.6 billion to 2.6 billion. The project pays itself back in around four years. NPV on the stage one is 400 million, increasing to 700 million with the second line. And all importantly, the cost of production, which is the C1 cost over the first 10 years, is around $6,700 a ton, which on today's nickel price of $11,400, there's significant margin there, and it means you're one of the lowest cost next generation producers out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know Brazil has been, you know, the economy has had a difficult period. It's gone through now. There's been a new president there. And wasn't the case the last sort of party or last ruling party where they were more social and this guy is more pro-business? Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, we've had three terms of PT, which effectively was the socialist Labour government. Mm-hmm. Change of government, new president sworn in January. This party is pro-business. It's talking about simplifying taxes, improving efficiency, and really opening Brazil for external investment. So we see this as a really great time to be in Brazil. It's a good jurisdiction, heavily endowed in terms of mining. And as testament today, you can operate there. I mean, we've got our construction license in a very short time frame compared to other places in the world. So, we think it's a great jurisdiction to be in. I think the next 2 to 3 years is going to really show uplift on where it's going.
Yeah, one other thing, you know, whenever someone's looking at commodities, always was looking at the long-term sort of profile. At the moment, we're going through, you know, Q4 of last year was awful, historically awful for many stock markets and many companies around the world. And a lot of that worry was about trade talks with China and stuff like that. But longer term, it's a good story for nickel, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. As you correctly say, I mean, nickel went from a high of $15,000 a ton in mid last year down to a low of sort of just over $10,000, and we've crept back up to $11,400 today. But if you look at the short to mid-term, nickel is a key fundamental metal for our everyday existence. Its main use is stainless steel, which is growing at about 5% year on year, and that's used in anything that's got a corrosive environment, all the way through from rail lines down to your kettle in your kitchen. And then on top of that sort of base demand of stainless, you've obviously got the electric vehicle arena, which is expanding significantly. And nickel is a key use in the batteries of these electric vehicles. So the nickel market is a pretty compelling space to be in. And because of the challenging environment over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, there's really been no significant money invested in the next generation of nickel projects to come online. And we are one of those unique opportunities where we have a world-class asset in a good jurisdiction scheduled to come online at the right point in that commodity cycle. And if you look at any of the banks' forecasts going out 2019, 2020 and beyond, pricing ranges anywhere from $15,000 to sort of $18,000 a ton. So it's a neat environment, and we're very well aligned to position ourselves in that.
Yeah, and so looking forward now, what's sort of the next big sort of milestone you're hoping to tick off the list there?
Yeah, so on Araguaia, obviously the construction license was a big one. We're now moving to the sort of the early works phase of engineering. That means putting more detail around the roads, the early infrastructure you need to start development. And then our focus for this year is really the project financing to make sure we can assemble a low cost financing package to develop the asset. So that's what we'll be focusing on Araguaia. And then our second project, Vermelho, which we own 100% of, which is within trucking distance of Araguaia. And we'll complete the test work that's underway to show we can produce battery grade nickel and cobalt. And then we'll be delivering an economic study to show what the fundamentals around the Vermelho project look like as we move towards demonstrating that we can build a 40 to 50,000 ton a year nickel business.
Yeah. And you mentioned the financing package there. I assume already you sort of putting out feelers and talking to parties already, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we engaged Endeavor Financial late last year, who are one of the sort of market leaders in the debt financing of these types of mining projects. Their last project was the $700 million financing for a gold project in Ecuador with Lundin Gold. We've got interest on the debt side, and we've had interest from the off-takers, and we've got interested on potential royalties and private equity funding. But I think the key is obviously when we've seen nickel prices sort of drop to the levels they have, we want to be financing this in the right nickel price environment. Otherwise, you end up with very expensive financing, and that's not beneficial for the company and shareholders. So it's about timing and pulling together the right financing package, but there's definitely interest.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, one final thing, Jeremy, for someone listening to this who likes the sound but not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, absolutely. We have two tier one nickel assets, Araguaia and Vermelho, both 100% owned, and both some of the highest grade nickel cobalt assets globally. We've got a strong shareholder base. We've got Teck, Glencore, JP Morgan, and a number of other London institutions on our register, and we're well funded. And the third point is the fundamentals behind nickel are compelling, and we expect to see pricing increase significantly over the next 12, 24, 36 months. And we are very well positioned to capitalize on that in terms of timing with Araguaia and then secondary bringing Vermelho online. So it's a pretty exciting story for us.
Yeah, and I notice if you look through your, you know, sort of RNS feed there, I'm looking here on Vox, there's quite a lot of directors making purchases at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, our view is that this is a great entry point. I mean, this is still, we haven't attained the sort of levels that we believe we can attain in terms of value for Araguaia, and it's a very good entry point for anybody looking at getting exposure to nickel.
Marvellous stuff. Jeremy, thanks for that, and no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Many thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Ciclatira, Executive Chairman of Live Company Group, LVCG. Is the ticker there. David, thanks for hooking up with me today.
Hello. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, you too. Now, it's a very exciting and transformational year for you, I suppose, in 2018. And so we're going to use this to look forward to what's going to happen, what you've done. But before we do that, as always, there's always new people joining. Just summarise the company for someone who's not familiar with it, if you could, David.
Live Company Group is a live-based business that owns the brand Brick Live. Brick Live is a leading global kids entertainment and educational brand, which is based around bricks.
Excellent stuff. And essentially, you've expanded so fast. How many countries are you in now, David?
We're in just under 50 countries, or 50 venues. Sorry. We're not in 50 countries, we're in 50 cities.
Mm-hmm. Excellent stuff. And so you've done so much, like I said, in the last year or so, and what does 2019 hold for you? Is it more of the same? Are you getting busier? Are you getting bigger? What's happening? What can people look forward to?
I think if we remember last October, we made an acquisition of a company called Bright Bricks. Mm-hmm. So the last couple of months of 2018 was all about the integration of Bright Bricks. Bright Bricks is a content producer, and the company has, I think, now expanded into several areas. It is its traditional starting point was to run exhibitions. We still do that. We're growing those exhibitions. We will have new exhibitions in 2019 in new cities. We also have expanded on our various brand extensions. So we'll have new cafes. We'll have new centres. These are permanent locations featuring Brick Live. But I think the most interesting thing is the fact is that the touring business will grow significantly. Because we now own the content provider, we're able to build tours around the world. If you recall, our first big tour was Brick Live Animal Paradise, which launched in Beijing last September. Actually, January 1 this year, the second city, this is a touring show going around 20 cities in 3 years in China, 17 endangered animals, full-size animals built out of Lego. Second city in Hainan Island opened in January this year, and over the next 2 years, it will be traveling around China. We also have, I think, explained how we are part of our touring, if you like, locations are zoos. And we are expanding our zoo program, and I would expect to see, we've got contracts for 7 zoos now, and probably the most interesting one is Brookfield in Chicago later this year. We're looking to see that zoo program at least double during 2019. And obviously the touring shows, we'll be building new content. We've already announced that we'll have Brachiosaurus, which is full-size dinosaurs. You know, we're talking about a full-size T-Rex and all of those sort of things. That launches in April in Marwell Zoo. We're in discussion to take that to different locations around Europe. And I call that now the blockbuster, the Brick Live blockbuster. Blockbusters are defined, I think, in the entertainment world as people, shows that attract over 100,000 people. So I will see Brickosaurus, I think, being a very interesting project going forward. We will be announcing various things as we go along, but it's interesting that the projects that we already have are all booked out to end of 2020 already. So what we've got is the touring asset business, which is Brick Live Touring, I think is going to be the most significant growth area of the company. And that's been made possible because we have purchased the content creating company, Brightbricks. So Brightbricks is very much the production hub of our business, and the brand building business is around Brick Live. I think if you look at Brick Live, we obviously started very strongly in Asia. I see that developing. I see more activity happening in China. I see more activity happening in Korea. We had 8 shows in Japan last year. That's going to increase. We are definitely in discussion to increase the number of shows that we have in ASEAN. America, 2 weeks' time, very exciting. We have our first show, Brick Live show in Dallas with the Dallas Cowboys, Live Nation. That's all happening. Tickets are going well. That's very exciting. And that's at the end of this month. We've already got one zoo project in America and in discussion for quite a few more. Then there's Europe. Obviously, this is a time of Brexit, all of these various things that are going on in Europe. Our UK business has significantly got better and better with the acquisition of Brightbricks. So we'll be looking to see our NEC flagship show, which we will be promoting ourselves. With the ability to use Brightbricks, we've made the decision to really build this as a self-owned show. That takes place at the end of the year. We're looking to add additional smaller shows in the UK. And really the one area that we, I guess, with everything that went on last year, we need to concentrate more is mainstream Europe. And where I spent a lot of my last days in 2018, exciting discussions for partnerships in Europe. So Asia, Europe, America, our key areas, our global brand, lots happening. And obviously, it's just the beginning of January.
Yeah, I was going to say, David, if you're hoping for a quiet year, this isn't the year, is it? And I suppose, how would you describe it? Would you describe last year as basically building the base and now you're building on that? But it's going to be a busy year, isn't it?
Last year was really proving the vision, really. The fact is that I had a vision that we could create a global brand. I think last year was all about, putting the flag in the proverbial city, testing. Korea was a great place for us because it's where it's been a sort of testing ground for much of what we've done. But I think that we also, when I look back, we had an executive board the other day. I looked around the table. There were only 2 of us who were there last January. So frankly, we've expanded our staff. We added staff towards the end of last year. We're adding more in the next 6 weeks. It's like everything. If you build something, you've got to build it organically, but at the same time, you've got to build it with good people. I think the big difference between last year and this is last year was all about getting there. Mm-hmm. This year is all about building the business, and of course, it's all about numbers because that's what shareholders care about. That's what I care about. This is the year where we are, if you like, numbers conscious. Last year was all about getting it started. This year is all about the business and building the business. We will be issuing Q1 a research note, or we won't be issuing, independent people will be issuing a research note, which will give investors more clarity on what the business means in terms of numbers and valuation. I'm very, very confident about that whole process. We now have a full business plan that takes us out into 2022. And so it's going to be a busy year, but I think it's going to be a very good year for the company and its shareholders.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I look forward to, you know, having you back on when, and undoubtedly you'll have some news out quite soon. But before we get to that, David, if someone's listening to this right now and likes the sound of what you're doing but are not following the story yet, as always, three reasons, if you could, why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, we're a content business, which is global, which is about kids, entertainment and education. I think if you look at the growth areas in content, kids has always been a growth area. And I think the ability to create and own our own IP, own our own content, the ownership of the IP and the global network are the two key elements of BrickLive.
Yeah, and you are a substantial shareholder yourself, aren't you? So you're aligned to shareholders, I suppose.
Well, yes, as I said a few times, I look at this a bit like the Barcelona Football Club. We're all fans, we're all shareholders. Yes, I do have more shares than some, but I'm very, very conscious that it's all about shareholder value. And I'm proud to be there with, whether it's an institutional shareholder, whether it's an individual shareholder, whether it's my own staff, all of whom now have options that kick in. So I'm really keen to be with the team.
Marvellous stuff. David, good to chat to you as always. And like I say, no doubt we'll be chatting again in not too distant future. Thanks very much.
I think so. Have a good year.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Miles Pelham, chairman of Obtala. OBT is the ticker there. Miles, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. Good to be here.
Yeah, you've had lots of news out of late. And before we get into some questions relating to that news, for people, you know, not familiar with the company, just give them a brief summary. Obtala, what's it all about, Miles?
Sure. So Obtala is about a 10-year-old company listed on London's AIM market. We're around a $30 million market cap, and we're a... After these recent announcements, we're solely a timber production and trading business focused in Africa.
Yeah. Now, you know, like I said, you've had a flurry of news the past week. Not most of that, you know, your first institutional shareholder and quite a strong one at that. Is this the first of many, Miles?
I certainly hope so. I mean, it's been a focus of us to try and get some serious players on the cap table. But yeah, I'm very happy. I think there are some key takeaways in that. A professional and very well-respected set of eyes has obviously taken a deep look at our business and felt that the 75 to 80% stock drop from the company's recent high represents an attractive investment once they've run the numbers. And then clearly they've put some serious money to work, as shown in the announcements. They've also undertaken some healthy DD into the company's trade finance vehicle, the 11.5% vehicle, and considered it, you know, appropriate and safe enough to invest money of their investors' funds into, which is a huge verification of our business model and processes. These are truly kind of institutional grade guys. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, that they've signaled that they want to be a long-term partner by inserting someone on our board. So they're all broadly positive and a game changer for us. And you know, one could consider that should bode well for hopefully other institutional investors to have similar views.
Yeah. And you've also sort of cleaned up the corporate structure here with the divestment of the agribusiness. So what impact will that have?
Mainly positive, of course, for a few reasons. Obviously, one negative would be that we're less diversified, but there's an argument as to whether having two businesses was taking up more of management's time. But look, the first positive is clearly that it will stop the bleed from a loss-making business. So annually, we save over $1 million, which is great. We'll be able to focus kind of all of our energies on one sole purpose of building out what we hope to build, the Glencore of African timber. And also, for such a small company, we had one of the most complex corporate structures in the small cap market. So we're now as clean as a whistle and therefore much more attractive to potential strategic partners and potential suitors.
Yeah. So you've just released your Q4 update today. You know, it points to more progress operationally. Are you happy with how it's going, the progress you're making?
No, yes, very happy. And actually take great pride in what we've achieved. It's so easy to see it on the RNS, but you know, those words on the screen really do take actions and energy and sweat and blood, and it's not easy and it's not as simple as people think. But we're making large and credible strides and have a sizable production business now to complement the trading side. So, yeah, happy.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, so your trade finance vehicle got a strong shot in the arm, didn't it, with last week's announcement. Is that enough for now?
Well, no, of course not. Look, it's not an insignificant amount, but we're really not going to grow into the Glencore of timber or African timber with a piddly kind of $14, $15 million. I've said it in many interviews before that the calibre of the management team that we've got running this business and not involved in the company to see it grow from a small to medium-sized player. I mean, the goal is to build this business into a dominant player in African timber in a kind of sustainable and methodical way. So we will want access to capital, many, many multiples of kind of what we've got at the moment. But, you know, that said, these are significant developments for the company. We'll just keep pushing forward.
Yeah, yeah. So we're at the start of 2019. Looking forward, what should we expect, you know, from this new look of Tala then, Miles?
Sure, look. 2019 looks set to be an extremely active year for us. Obviously, as announced last year, we've got the rename and rebrand to the much stronger brand of Woodbar, which has strong credibility in timber circles. So we should expect that to complete in first quarter. We've got to work out ways to institutionalise the ITF scheme and get that hurtling hopefully towards a three-figure sum. But, you know, be that via potential listing as a fund or kind of some new age approach. We've got to bed down the board and its new members and set some clear and aggressive KPIs for this new streamlined business. And, yeah, announced last week was that Arden will be our new nomad and broker. So we've got to work with them to get a research piece out on the company so that investors can kind of take a measure to our progress versus forecast multiples. Obviously, at the same time, try and make a big push to get new blood into the stock and kind of increase the daily liquidity that will no doubt involve some roadshows, probably surrounding the UK Investor Show, which we regularly attend in London, and also partnerships with the big boys of timber globally, so we can be their go-to partner in Africa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, last thing to do, Miles, as always, if someone's listening, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Sure. Look, first reason is that we are an ethical and sustainable company. It really runs in our blood, and it's incredibly important to us, as illustrated by the award of the most socially responsible small cap award in 2018. Second is that investors can now look upon a clean corporate structure with a clear singular goal of being a dominant force in African timber production and trading. Cognizant that this company has been many things to many people over the years, so kind of like with a strike down of Mordor's staff, that's really over. We're absolutely not going back to try and bits and bobs here and there. There's real adults in the room with a clear vision about building a world-class timber business. And third is that new investors now get access to a company that's taken 30 months to clean up and restructure and refinance. Management have worked incredibly hard to move this company kind of onto the launch pad, so it's now time to kind of fill this rocket up with fuel, which is the trade finance, which I've talked about many, many times. Mm-hmm. So that won't be a surprise. But look, I'm confident 2019 we'll see the tankers lined up. But time will tell, and of course we can be measured on that.
Yeah, I do like the phrase, there's real adults in the room now. Miles, thanks for that, fella. Listen, like I say, you got a lot going on in 2019, so no doubt we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Super. Thanks, Justin. All the best.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is oil and gas sector specialist Malky. You're right, fella.
I'm very well indeed, actually. It's there's a lot of excitement. Good morning, Justin. So, a lot of excitement in the sector.
Yeah.
The oil price is having has had a big bounce.
Yeah.
And there are a number of reasons for that, and some exciting things going on in the shares as well. So
yeah, well, take us through. What's the first cab off the rank here, Malky?
Well, the first, I mean, to be honest, the first cab off the rank is the oil price, which is up till Friday was up for 9 consecutive days. Which was incredible, really, because it was up nearly 20%. It was up 19% over the 9 days, taking an average, and that's an incredible bounce from the bottom. Last week, West Texas was up 7.6%, Brent was up 6%. You know, there's a lot going on here, but you know as well as I do, and the market's never quite worked this out, that commodities and oil is no different. Always overcorrect on the upside and the downside.
Yeah,
we talked about this at $85 when everyone was suddenly going for $100 a barrel. Now, you know, they're not going for $100 a barrel, but they, you know, they all thought it was the end of the world 10 days ago when, you know, the oil price was through $50 for Brent and so on. It's a combination of things, really. The OPEC cuts genuinely are coming in and harder than expected. There's no way that Saudis are going to get away with any Aramco deal and so on without having a decent oil price, as we said before. We've got bids in the sector, which I talked about last week, and I'll talk about again today. Bids always mean that, you know, bigger companies with cash think that they can buy companies in the stock market, and it's cheaper than buying oil by going out and drilling for it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a lot of short covering. There was, you know, as you know, there were a lot of people, you know, that what they call themselves the professional investors, the hedge funds and the traders. You know, they were very, very short. Their long positions all got disappeared, and they were all short. And I wrote before Christmas that, you know, that's inevitably an accident waiting to happen. And sure enough, what's happened is that, you know, they've done a lot of short covering in the last few days, which has pushed the price up. And the one final thing is that it was absolute joy to see Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Societe Generale and Beringbird all cutting their annual oil price forecast as well.
Yeah, I know. Well, do you know what? I mean, the markets are like a pendulum, aren't they? What I laugh at is, I talked to quite a few people who've been to college, you know, and studied economics, and they're always taught that the market is a efficient pricing model, and it's not. If you well research on a company, you can know a lot more than the guy down the road who's also, you know, a passive investor, for example. And that's why it's not efficient, and that's why you get things. People start panicking, people start selling, they oversell, selling begets selling, and all of a sudden you get a market that's oversold. Like you say, you may have some short positions closing and all that stuff. So it all leads into this, you know, false overpricing, and then it bounces back like a pendulum comes back, you know. And so we see this happen a lot. So the oil price sold off sort of really aggressively, didn't it? And then it all of a sudden, it's going to bounce back sooner or later. The problem is guessing where the bottom is, but it will bounce back.
Yeah.
You know?
And it always, unless you feel that the machine isn't able to do it, and in the oil price, the machine is OPEC, mm-hmm. and the Saudis run OPEC, and they still do, and so that's what's happening. So, yeah it's picked up nicely. So what we've seen, I'll just see off those two bids. We've seen the DNO bid for Faro has gone unconditional in all respects. It's a shame, really, but again, you know, we talk about markets, and you know, if somebody comes in for a cash bid. You say that the shareholders are, you know, short-termist and so on. There's no doubt about that, but that's what they're doing. So they did end up selling out the Faro management. I'm sure that Faro management will reappear, and I'm sure that, you know, that they will come back again and do well. In the meantime, DNO have got a sort of ready-made oil company, I think quite cheaply, you know, and they've handled it in a very crafty and canny manner by coming in with their big lumps of cash at a time when, you know, the market needed it. The oil price was down, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as that had finished, we received a, it's not actually a bid, but PT Medco have made an indicated bid for Ophir. 48.5p. The company say that they spoke to them a month or so ago when the bid was 58p. This lower bid, obviously, as I say, indicated bid, they haven't actually put a bid out yet. The indicated bid is at the lower level because, well, I imagine just because Fortuna, the fact that the company lost the license there. And the Ophir board have announced this morning that they've technically unanimously rejected the bid, or alleged bid, and wait and see. I'm sure it's not the end of it. I'm sure that, you know, you don't get to the stage where PT Medco, you know, went to the process and everything else. And so they'll come back firstly with a formal bid, as they will have to do under the rules, and secondly, probably a higher bid. It's interesting to note that PT Medco is the ex-Premier Oil people in that part of the world. So it's going to be quite a lot of fun and games.
Yeah.
And bids in the sector is always a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anything else happening?
Right, I've got three or four quick companies to mention. SDX Energy has announced this morning an Egypt update. This is broken down into two. First of all, they've announced the preliminary results of the well on which is SRM3 in South Ramadan in Egypt, offshore Egypt. They have encountered pay in three different intervals, but this is not like a sort of, you know, your ordinary bog standard, you know, onshore whatever pay. This is a highly faulted structure here, so they're now going to test it. So the bottom line is that with the testing underway, I think it would be wrong for people to get too carried away. The shares have gone up a bit this morning. That's for two reasons. One is that, you know, this might be successful. SGS got 12.5% of this. If it worked, absolutely fine. But I just think it'd be a good idea not to get too carried away. There is pay there, but it's highly faulted, and I'd like to see the results of this one first. And the other part of the announcement saying that South Dusuk, the development has now been finally approved in all ways. The building of the pipeline and the central gas facilities is underway. This one is still scheduled. It's on schedule now for towards the end, the first gas towards the end of the first half of this year. Then they'll be producing between 50 and 60 million scf a day of gas, which is incredibly good for them. And well, elsewhere in Egypt, of course, they're doing very well. We expect South Dusuk to, they're just doing some seismic at the moment. That'll be completed next month, and then as soon as they finish that, they'll be processing and interpreting that, which will give them an idea of what wells they're going to drill in South Dusuk in the second half of this year, which is very positive. There's a big analyst visit to Egypt for SDX in April. And they'll do a full announcement at the end of this month on Morocco and Egypt and everything else. But they had to announce the result of this well, and that South Dusuk is going well. So I remain very positive on SDX. It's looking good again, like a number of other things. It's been in the doldrums, but picking up very nicely.
Yeah, absolutely. SDX Energy, marvellous. Hopefully we get to...
Okay, briefly, I'll mention President Energy, which we've talked about a lot of times, but the good reason for that is that they've continued to deliver the goods, and they announced last week that their exit rate of production for Argentina in 2018 was 3,300 barrels a day, which is an exceptional performance, and up 50% year on year. That three-well campaign that I've been talking you through over the last few months was way better than expectations. But interestingly, the company, when they announced this, they're saying, we're not looking at history, you know, that's what it is, we're looking future. The good thing is that, you know, 3,300 barrel a day produces a huge amount of revenue. They'll be able to fund a substantial drilling campaign, and they'll be... I think they'll be doing well workovers, reopening of old wells, and some exploration wells, I expect, this year. The acquisition, one of the acquisitions they made last year was something called Estancia Vieja, which is a gas field, which is now going to power up. It'll be responsible, it already is responsible for powering their fields in that part of Argentina, and before too long should be able to export and actually sell gas in its own right. Early days yet, but that should be very important. Mm-hmm. Bottom line for President is that Peter Levine is really delivering the goods. It's got high margin, cash generating revenue for shareholders. He keeps getting the production up. As I say, it's turning into a very, very exciting business, President Energy.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Yeah, I had Peter on the podcast a while back. We'll have to get him back on, I think. But, yeah, PPC there.
Actually, because he lives in the States, but he's over in London. I'm seeing him next week. So okay. I'm seeing him this week. Actually, he's over here now. So get hold of him.
Yeah, definitely. Marvellous.
I'm going to stay in South America for Amerisur, because although I've talked about that before, everyone's redoing the numbers. We're speaking to the company at the moment, and this is following the discovery they have had on CP05 to the north of their traditional acreage in southern Colombia. So it's to the north of Colombia. This is beginning to look like it is an absolutely storming discovery, producing maybe 4,500 barrels a day on test at the moment. And Amerisur have 30-odd% of this. So, you know, we're expecting them to see, you know, more than half of Amerisur's production from the whole country coming from these two wells in CPO5 this year. But they've got a campaign going now. I mean, they're funded because they've got plenty of, having spent a year throwing off cash. They're going to drill four wells, maybe more, and at relatively modest cost in CPO5. They can drill four wells from the existing pad, and then they can drill another one either adjacent time-wise or afterwards. I think that the economics of this oil for Amerisur is fantastic. I mean, it's because they sell the oil at the wellhead. There are no transport costs. I mean, you know, you can pay up to $12 a barrel to transport crude oil in other parts of the country, so no additional transport costs. It's really light oil, which is good because quite a lot of the rest of the oil in Colombia is heavy oil, and so light oil is good because it can be mixed with the heavy oil, so it's in great demand. I noticed that the company broker has put out a piece of research increasing its target price from 20p to 35p. So that's a 75% increase in the target price. And I think Amerisur has had a run, but it's only just started.
Yeah. AMER, absolutely. Definitely the bottom's in now, I think. Anything else?
Yeah, and one brief one. I noticed that Premier Oil, the Sunday Times had a story which linked it with buying the Chevron assets, which are up for sale in the North Sea at the moment, and at a cost of $1.5 billion, which would involve a massive rights issue or placing. Well, it certainly would, because the Premier's market cap this morning is just over £500 million. There isn't a way in the world that they can get away with doing this, much as they would love to. They have talked about, you know, the article talked about selling off Mexico and so on, but and becoming a North Sea player. As I say, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. Nice assets. But they, I don't think, I mean, I thought they would sell off the Mexican assets in due course, but I've certainly been told in no uncertain terms that's not going to be the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're drilling there at the moment and they've got appraisal coming up and so on. It would be very nice to make Premier a big North Sea player, you know, with the success it's had from Catcher. But he can't do an equity issue for anywhere close to $1.5 billion. And it's already, you know, well known for its debt pile, so it ain't going to increase the debt pile very much. So I think a step too far, but just proves that, you know, these companies quite rightly do always look at everything that comes up, and so they should. I asked Tony Darren to Premier whether he'd looked at Ophir, and he said, of course, but the asset, the way the assets pan out doesn't work quite so well. But I think that Premier are doing very well at the moment. They're in the back of this. They're doing well, developing. Obviously, Catch is going well. Tollmount is going very well indeed and will increase this year. They've got the Mexico where they're doing well, obviously Southeast Asia, and with Sealand to come in due course. They'd love to, but they can't afford to buy these assets in the North Sea.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Malky, is that it or anything else?
That's it, yeah.
Marvellous stuff. Well, listen.
And furious.
Yeah, exactly. We'll catch up next week, Malky. Thanks very much.
Yeah, look forward to it.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Horizonte Minerals, HZM. Jeremy was on the podcast earlier. At four, Mobile Streams, MOS. I did have a mention, talk about those on the podcast on the weekend. It's a little dirty punt for me, but you never know. But, you know, it's nowhere near confirmed the company's improved yet, or, you know, it's getting better. They had an update today. And in fact, the Indian revenue is looking very good. It's up, but there's some uncertainty there. But it's a tiny company, tiny market cap. It's like £550,000. That's all it is. So it's way below 1 million market cap. And the revenue is about 3 million. They're burning about 100 grand a month, so they are loss-making at the moment. They've had issues in Argentina, which was the core market, but they're pivoting away from that into India. There's potential there, but who knows? Early days, highly risky, and do your own research. I may be completely wrong on it, actually. And maybe, who knows? If I'm right, though, it could do very well because, like I said, tiny valuation. This is not investment advice, just an idea that I think could be a bad one. on my part. There's lots of other ideas I have. They're a lot more solid. Okay, Nautilus Marine Services. That's NAUT at three. At two, Red Emperor Resources, RMP. And number one, most followed company, Bidstack, BIDS. Another investment idea I like a lot. I've done a video on. And just the power of the podcast, because James, the CEO, came on the podcast on Friday discussing the RNS. By the way, after the RNS, the share price was down over 10%. And then he came on the podcast. I released the podcast at, say, 1 o'clock. And all of a sudden, the buys started coming in because James expressed how the company was doing, you know, like a human rather than in RNS text like people read. And people can see the potential there, massive potential. Bids, that is. Okay. Here we go. Top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Andlas Energy and Power. Update on Bunga Mass. At four, Highlands Natural Resources. Eight, Producing Wells, East Denver. At three, Jangada Mines. Operational update and Q1 schedule. At two, Horizonte Minerals. Construction of license award for Araguaia project. Jeremy's on the podcast. And number one, Ascent Resources. Corporate update. AST. Ticker. Yeah. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.